You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
And the question I want to pose this hour is whether or not schools should be and can be places for political expression. And I wonder what you make of that. And of course, the reason why I'm asking this question is that there were two learners at Herzliya that demonstrated quietly during a prize-giving ceremony their disassociation with the singing of the Israeli anthem as a form of quiet protest. And you can imagine what kind of consternation that caused among alumni, parents, teachers, fellow pupils, and other people as well in the country, because we are a country that is a nation of protest. But also globally, we've seen huge contestation across campuses, for example, but also in major cities around the world, as there is this tug and war that takes place for controlling state power, corporate power, societal power. So protesting and the ethics around protesting, for me, is a massively interesting political and an intellectual question. And here we have an example that is close to home around our schools. So I don't know where this conversation is going to go. All I can tell you is, what are some of the issues that made me interested to follow how this conversation has played out thus far, including the views of the people that I'm going to introduce to you over the course of this hour. I'm really interested in, amongst others, the following questions. Should schools be apolitical? And what does that mean? Should we in South Africa have schools that are founded on Zionism? And by the way, I'm open here for education. I'm not even sure I truly understand what Zionism means. Should children and teenagers be respected as capable of political expression and political thought? And what happens to their political rights, particularly, which some people are overlooking in this debate, the fact that as a child at the age of 5 or 6, you don't necessarily choose which school you go to. So it's not even obvious that someone had signed up for the ethos of the school where they landed up. So those are just some of the questions that come out for me of this particular issue. And I wonder what comes up for you, what your answers are to these questions, and whether you think they're questions that I haven't even tossed out in the first minute or two that should be part of this conversation. Give us a call throughout. If you're in Cape Town on 021-446-0567, and if you are here in Johannesburg on 011-883-0702. Let me introduce our guest. We've got an Oxford student who is also former national head of Habonim, the youth organization, Ilan Price. Ilan, thank you so much for being part of this conversation. It really is awesome speaking to you.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, the audio is not great. We're going to see whether we can just up your volume a little bit, because I love that brain of yours. And as you know, I've been following your trajectory for many, many, many years. So we really want to hear everything you have to say. We'll come back to you, but welcome to the conversation. And then we have one of our 1976 student leaders, of course, a very familiar name and voice and thought leader, Seth Mazibuko. Seth, thank you so much for agreeing to be part of this conversation.
Good morning, and good morning, South Africa. And I am very humbled to be invited to participate in this discussion.
The pleasure is ours, Seth. And here in the studio with me, I've got Deep Fried Man, the comedian, who's also digital editor of The Citizen. And I must say, you've been doing an excellent job. I did see you guys getting flack for one story yesterday on Twitter. But you've done some really good work being back in journalism as a journalism philosophy student who's also a comic, Daniel Friedman. Daniel, thanks so much for being part of this conversation.
Hi, Eusebius. Thank you.
I'm about to fail in something I wasn't going to do. I wanted to bring that red clock. I used to terrify Daniel's cohort of my first tutorial group with a red clock that I used to bring in, that used to frighten them as a tutor when I was at Rhodes. It's wonderful having you. I love what you've been doing over the years, Daniel, and fantastic to have you back at The Citizen and doing some great journalism. Do we have that audio able? And we're going to play it. Okay, so for context, I want you to listen to this youngster articulating their political thought and also why it is that the school setting is a setting where they opted to express their political thought.
Okay, so the reasons I did it are kind of twofold with an extra minor reason at the end. So I'm going to go through the first two main ones, which are split up into a principal reason why we did it and then a practical reason, so a practical thing and a practical effect we hope to come out of doing this. So under the principal reason, the problem that we felt is that we were being forced to stand and sing for an anthem that we felt that we couldn't because of our principal beliefs. We felt like standing there is a sign of support for the Israeli anthem. And because of our beliefs that we don't support currently what Israel is doing, we can't stand there. It's like in America, when you have NFL players who take a knee during the anthem, they support what that anthem stands for, but they don't believe the country is fulfilling those ideas, so they can't stand for it. HaTikvah on its own is a beautiful song, but besides being HaTikvah, it is also the anthem of Israel. And so if we stand for it, we're not only standing for the words inside of it, but we're also standing for what Israel as a country is right now, which we don't feel that we could, right? We were being forced to do that, and we didn't want to. We didn't feel like our beliefs were then being shown. Secondly, a practical reason. Herzliya as a school has a big problem with the restriction of information, right? So a lot of the time teachers will say that they don't like restrict your freedom of speech and you're allowed to talk about whatever you want. But besides the fact that that's not really true, even if it was true, even if you were allowed to talk about what you want to talk about, it doesn't matter because inside classes, when the teachers teach you stuff, they only teach you one side of the story. So while a Jewish life teacher might say, oh no, it's totally fine for you to talk about pro-Palestine ideas, he's only going to teach you pro-Israel ideas inside that class. So unless you go outside of your way to learn pro-Palestine ideas, you're only going to know pro-Israel ideas. And that means that a lot of the kids in Herzliya only have pro-Israel ideas. And when they think about, okay, what is a pro-Palestine person, they think of like the other, they think of a terrorist, someone they cannot relate to. We hope, me and my friend now, that when people think, okay, what is a pro-Palestine view, the kids in Herzliya, they now think, oh, it's Gabriel, it's Joseph, it's people that I know that are normal humans. So I understand that these views can actually be held by normal humans. I might disagree with pro-Palestine views, but I now no longer think of them as like crazy and the other. I now think of them as like normal and I can engage with them in a positive manner. Then the final reason, and the one that I felt really strongly connected to, is that there is a huge divide inside the Jewish community. A divide based on politics, based on whether you're pro-Palestine or pro-Israel, right? I feel like this is very harmful because no one talks about it properly because people feel like if they talk about it, people are just going to get into a fight. And it means that there's lots of anger broiling underneath the Jewish community that creates this divide, right? It means that even when someone does something such as small as like this, or even though this is a big thing, someone wears a pro-Palestine scarf like Josh Brumberg did in King David, there is such a huge outroar and the Jewish community gets so split and angry at each other in such extremes and like we don't get any discourse. So what I hope to do is that when I do something like this, it forces people to talk. It forces people to actually have discussions over these issues, right? Which they aren't doing if something like this doesn't happen. And I hope that once this all dies down, because it will in the end, people will be closer to the middle, right? The extreme left-wing people will be closer to understanding why the extreme right people have their views, and the people on the extreme right are closer to understanding why the extreme left have their views. And it's closer to becoming a normal thing that people talk about instead of this taboo, evil, like insidious thing that divides our community up. I think that's really important.
I don't know the name of the youngster because the school is not divulging the names to protect them, but I thought that's lucid. I think that is cogent. I think that would pass our little philosophical test for what counts as a good argument. Why is there so much beef around this, Daniel, including on your Facebook page?
Yeah. So first of all, I'd just like to say that any listener who takes my personal views as being views that represent the Jewish community in South Africa as a whole is mistaken. I'm someone whose views cast me as a renegade. I know that, you guys did try to get someone on from the SA Jewish Board of Deputies. And if you did, you...
Yeah, they declined. We did. The last thing I wanted was to have liberal consensus.
Yeah.
Because A, that's dull. And B, it's not true of the diversity of views that in fact exist. But we did. We also, for the record, asked the school to come on and they simply referred us back to their last statement.
Okay. So in other words, what you've got now is you've got me. And my views are at odds with the mainstream in the Jewish community. And my views are way more in line with what that young man said. And there's nothing in his statement that I can disagree with. And also it's something that for me is quite moving, because I went to King David myself, and it's something that I don't think we could have seen at the time. And it's, you know, it's something that, that shows that slowly but surely we're those of us who have the views that we have about Zionism are getting to a point where it's become what we hope, and what he said as well in his statement, is that we hope that one day it will become normalized.
Daniel, for you, is it primarily, obviously logically can be both, but honestly for you, just speaking from the heart, is it primarily a speech rights issue, or, because I've seen you associate yourself with the remarks of Ronnie Catherall's, is it also about the actual substantive issues here in relation to Zionism?
Well, for me, it is the latter. For me, it is, but I am very happy and also very able to divorce the issue from that and to look at it as a sort of blunt freedom of speech issue, as in, should students be allowed to protest at school? And of course, I would say, you know, my argument would be that, yes, they should.
So what are your thoughts on a school that is founded explicitly on an affinity with Zionism?
I don't think I could say that there's anything morally wrong in starting a school that represents any given viewpoint, as long as the parents are happy sending their kids there. But what I have a problem with is that what it speaks to is the most Jewish South Africans will tell you that to be a Jew and to be a Zionist are inseparable, as in you can't be the one without the other. Any Jew who is not a Zionist is cast as being sort of a fringe sort of element who's not a real Jew. And for many people, you can't have the one without the other. So the problem is Herzliya and King David, these are Jewish schools. And I went to those schools because I am a Jew. And there's a big sense that if you're going to these schools, you are adhering to Zionism. You are standing up, you are singing Hatikvah, and you are adhering to Zionism. Whereas I would argue that there needs to become space within the Jewish community for acceptance of the idea that not all Jews are Zionists, which is fact. And the fact that Zionism is a political ideology which can be entirely divorced from Judaism.
Ilan, I want to bring you in here. How do you see the issues in terms of how we need to map out what is at stake here to avoid an intractable debate that is not useful?
So I think that you're right to point out that there are some people for whom this is an important issue because of the substance, because they agree with the protest against Israel's policies, and that's the conversation that should be had. And certainly that's the conversation that's the conversation that our students, that those students would like us to be having. But of course, there's other people for whom it is the protest itself that has become the main topic of conversation.
Yeah.
And in my view, the of the questions that you highlighted right at the beginning, the voice notes that you play from this student speaks first and foremost to the question of can we expect and should we allow our students to be politically engaged and express political views? Because I think it would be hard to listen to that and be of the opinion afterwards that this is a student who is not able to think for themselves, not able to articulate a position, who's not in favor of debate or discussion. And so a view of schools as spaces where students should refrain from political engagement and should be kind of politically neutral spaces in terms of the student body, I would view that as a very problematic view. And I would be happy to talk about my experience at least which motivates me not to underestimate young people to that extent.
Yeah.
And also to view in some sense the school's role as
that's
facilitating
right.
this kind of
Okay, and we'll come back to those examples, because I know it's that experience in part experientially that you are drawing on, Ilan, as you're reflecting on this being version 2 of this kind of thing.
Yeah.
I can take another example. Last year in Durban as well, the same kind of thing. Of course, you have young black pupils who have views about, say, EFF or about land, and then you have some old fart that used to be an excellent and a cool South African-born sportsman that need not be named, who then gets mightily cheesed over what happens at his school as an alma mater. So there are also interesting questions here about ownership. Who owns the ethos of a school? Who decides what it should be across time? But I want to bring you in here, Seth. The reason I explicitly asked my producers to see whether we can get you or one of your cohort on the show is that this is not a conversation that is specifically about the Jewish community. The first and most obvious point in history that came up for me as I read Facebook posts by my friends and colleagues like Richard Poplek was that we have a rich history in this country of politicized learners in our high schools who were an important part of the struggle against apartheid, particularly when the state was so good at banishing the elders. So reflect on that for me, and what insights from your experience can be brought to bear on how we view teenagers, school pupils, and political identity now that we are in a democracy.
Maybe one should even start here. We must remember that in 1976, when we were under the Department of then Bantu Education, you were not only under a particular political dispensation, but that political dispensation was also based on a particular religion, which was Christianity. So everything that determined the policies of any schools was in any way influenced, I'm talking public schools here, was influenced by a particular religion, at the time, Christianity. Now, that means if I were to stand up against a particular principle that is in the rules of the school,
yes,
I would in a way be also be standing against a particular rule that is in a particular religion. Let's take a pause. For a girl to, for instance, have long hair, we still have that as a problem. For Rastafarians, we still have a problem. We still have all those problems even in the current democracy. You just cited an incident in KZN of political issue of students who were EFF supporters. But the point I'm trying to make is that our education, unfortunately, immediately when you marry education with divorce, immediately when you marry education with religion, you are immediately exposing that religion and that education to political analysis. And immediately you are exposing it to any form of defiance, any form of a criticism, any form of protest. You cannot say, I am separating one from another.
Okay, absolutely. That's certainly true. Ilan, I want to bring you back in here. Is there a nuance that we ought to bring into the conversation in relation to the distinction between public schools and private schools, or is that not salient?
So, David, I think before asking that question, I think it's first worthwhile distinguishing between schools being political in the sense of the school body and the school institution being political,
yes,
and its student body engaging in political thoughts, political expression, political protest. I think in the former case, in the question of should we have politically aligned schools or ideologically found schools that are founded in some sort of ideological alignment, I'd say yes, there probably is a distinction, at least in general, to be made between public and private schools. I think that the kind of justification probably for private schools being allowed to organize themselves around some sort of communal, what some might call political ideology or political idea or maybe religious idea, I think is founded on freedom of association and the spirit of that idea that you should be able to form meaningful communities And while schools in these communities tend, of course, they're first and foremost educational institutions, they're also principally communal institutions, and they're an important part of that kind of community forming and association.
But there's a balance to be struck here, right? There's a balance to be struck that I thought Sam Musker articulated very well. One can respect the religious freedom. One can respect all sorts of other rights. And by the way, this school professes to be non-denominational, even if there is a bias in respect of Zionist ideology. So it's very careful to not flout the constitutional prescripts. But surely the balance to be struck here is between a community and a ethos that even a reasonably homogenous community can inject into an institution, Ilan, and respecting the individual rights that can't be easily proscribed without very good justification of an individual teenager to depart from the founding values of that school, not least when we consider that children, as is the case with many religions, aren't born Catholics, aren't born Islamic, but are born into families that have parents that happen to have those doctrines that they have internalized.
So I 100% agree with you. So my point there is was just to suggest that while that justification for a school having some sort of alignment or ideology exists potentially in private school cases, there's overarching responsibilities on public schools, but I certainly think that there are very clear and very strong obligations that come with deciding with an educational institution deciding to define itself in a particular way.
And absolutely, yeah. I'm just going to take a break there. Unfortunately, we've got to take a commercial break. I hate stopping you people in mid-thought, particularly when the thought is as sharp as yours, but we have to do that.
Eusebius Makaiser. Eusebius Makaiser. On 702 at Cape Talk.
24 minutes before 11 o'clock, we're asking the broader question whether schools are, can be, should be places for political expression. The particular example that has occasioned the question today, but of course it applies to all such institutions, is of course what had happened recently at Herzliya, and where you had two pupils of the school that silently protested while the Israeli anthem had been sung. And this has raised all sorts of interesting questions, including about political expression, political identity, and the place or not of protest in our schools. Shimron, good morning to you, and thank you so much for coming on the show.
Eusebius, thank you so much for having me.
It's only a pleasure, sir.
Yes, I just wanted to clarify one point, if I may, Eusebius. There was an inaccurate misstatement that was stated earlier that the Jewish Board of Deputies declined to come on the show, and I just wanted to correct that for your listeners.
Do you speak for them? Are you with the board?
No. So let me just clarify who I am. I am a board member of South African Friends of Israel.
Oh, okay.
And I work with the Jewish Board of Deputies. I've been on various leadership positions, and I'm personally friends with the person who was nominated to come on.
Okay. So let's make it very quick so that we can get back to the substantive discussion.
So just very, very quickly, they definitely did not decline to come on the show. The Jewish Board of Deputies always wishes to debate and discuss such important issues, and this is an extremely important issue, and I thank you, therefore, for having such a topic on your show. And it's just that Mr. Shulman was wrongly informed that it was no longer going to be a debate. So that is what happened. So he...
A debate as opposed to?
Did not decline to come on the show.
Hold on. I mean, it's very weird that you're speaking on his behalf, by the way, but let me honor your ability to apparently know what might have transpired between him and my producer. You're very brave to do so on this show, well, because you weren't part to that conversation. Yes, but nevertheless, on your version of what you had heard from your BFF, what was his expectation in terms of the debate that is now not happening?
So, no, well, what happened, as I said, obviously this is, as you said, through my, as you call them, BFF. but the fact is, he has specifically informed me that he was informed that this would no longer be a debate, and therefore the show had been effectively changed.
Okay.
And the but you stated, I think, I don't know, about 15 minutes ago, that they had declined to come on the show. So I just think that needed to be clarified. The Jewish Board of Deputies never has declined to come on such a show, and I have the National Director has confirmed that of the Jewish Board of Deputies, and maybe you can even get her on the line if possible.
I'm sure, she's obviously I'm sure we're okay.
Yeah, she can come on if she wants to. We'll give her a chance to come on. I'm not vested in this conversation. I was saying to Deep Fried Man here in the studio before we started, for me, there are some really fascinating normative political questions and some interesting legal questions that arise here.
I'm not even interested
in Zionism and where I fall on that. And sometimes I disappoint my friends who have strong views on the matter. But thank you. Thank you so much, Hiram. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much. And I think that, especially, as stated, I'm a human rights lawyer, and I think that the debate...
Okay, while I have you, can we rather do something more interesting, because we're wasting time now? Can I ask you this question?
Anyway, you so
no, hold on. I want to ask you this question. Are you excited?
Okay.
Are you excited to hear a teenager with a political view expressing that freely without worrying about reprisal?
Extremely excited. I think that there's just a time and a place, that's all. The fact is that during the singing of at an assembly, the singing of the Israeli anthem, this is just not the time and place. There are multiple debates at Herzliya, which happen on a consistent basis. There are people from all shades. I mean, Jonathan Shapiro, kids go to Herzliya, and he is definitely, by no form of imagination, a Zionist. He's vehemently anti-Zionist, and he sends his kids there. There is a space for debate and discussion.
But who decides, Shimron? Because here's my beef with your argument, right? There's this thing, and we find the same thing with the Fallists. That's why I'm saying this is not even a conversation particular to the Jewish community. This is a South African conversation, and frankly, a global one. We could have had many case studies that segue into the principled issues here. And for me, the principled issue test was playing out. Can you identify that right?
Yes, okay. So that is precisely the point. You would have been a very good constitutional law lecturer. the point is, the right to freedom of association in our constitution states that an organization or association or a school is entitled to set its mores within its association or jurisdiction, as so long as they don't infringe on the rights of anyone else. However, having said that, as you correctly stated, Section 36 of the Constitution states that every single right is entitled to be limited, even the right to life, and that includes the right to freedom of expression. The right to freedom of expression is never absolute. You can't say whatever you feel.
Sorry, can I stop you there?
I'm going to stop you there because I've given you plenty of time, Daniel.
Can I? So you're saying that they have to be limited. Your right to protest or your freedom of expression has to be limited at some point. Surely that applies to when it's hurt, you know, potentially hurting someone else, potentially damaging someone else. Surely it doesn't apply to simply when you don't like what two people are doing because they're bending a knee. How can you argue that that is a part of freedom of expression that needs to be limited by the Constitution?
The fact is that this was not a debate on Israel. If this was a debate on Israel, then I would say they would perfectly have been entitled to do whatever form of expression so long as it did not result in hate.
No, they don't, Shimron. Your example is the equivalent of telling the gender activists at the IEC elections results center that because the occasion was not explicitly to have a debate about gender-based violence and rape, it was inappropriate to silently go to the front while the former president was speaking and to have placards up saying, remember Kwesi. You know, if you want to keep this legalistic, and I'm not sure that is the right and only framework, that the the harm, as Daniel says, would have to be articulated. What harm was suffered by either the IEC or by Jacob Zuma when there's a silent protest that doesn't interfere with the main order of the business? Mutatis mutandis, as you lawyers like to say, what is the harm that the school suffers when there's a silent protest? I want to bring in Josh Broomberg in here. Josh, I loved how absolutely brilliant your Facebook post was on the matter. And I honestly, I'm in awe of your maturity beyond your years since your high school debating days. You've gone through something similar. I struggled with your post, I have to confess, because it compelled me to think very carefully about a strategic question. If we have liberal consensus as a bunch of liberals who have a view on Zionism or rights to protest, we still need to think tactically, and this is the most generous I could be in understanding one of your points, in how we go about dealing with people who differ from ourselves. Can you articulate that point and react to anything else that you've heard? And by the way, welcome to the show. It's lovely having you on my show.
Thank you very much for having me, and thanks for your kind words. I will try re-articulate something. I want to be very careful here. I think you know, the discussion that just preceded my little monologue here demonstrates one of the problems that I was trying to get at, which is that, you know, ultimately when we talk about rights, and this is a controversial statement, but when we talk about rights, we're talking about a set of values that people believe in, right? And that I think many, if not all, people believe in. But when we arrive at situations where two sets of values are conflicting, we see that those values are not actually very good at changing other people's minds. So, you know, you're saying there's a right to freedom of expression. I think it's uncontroversial that there's a right to freedom of expression here. I don't think the other guest, I didn't catch his name, was very compelling in saying that there isn't a right to freedom of expression. But the point is that right is not going to change his mind, and it's not going to change anyone else in the community's mind, because they're saying time and place, right? And what they're really saying by that is, we were offended and hurt by this. It contradicted our values. And we don't really care that there's this abstract notion of the right to freedom of expression.
Yeah.
And so I actually think that if I can just bring this home, that as a kind of liberal community, there is a stronger place to base our argument, actually, than the right to freedom of expression. I think that if you understand a community as an ecosystem, and if people genuinely want that ecosystem to be as strong as it can be, then the only way to find strength is in allowing diversity of opinion and in exploiting the strength of young people to be rebellious rather than trying to suppress that rebellion, actually exploiting it to create more diversity and more strength in your community. And so what I was really saying is that it's not That's really right. like, you know, let's compromise our values to be pragmatic. It's more that the best way to understand this is not through value, not directly just through asserting values, but through a kind of more nuanced and practical worldview.
But do you think that that there is equal disappointment to be described in how this played out between the learners and the school? Because one of the points you articulated, and I was trying very hard, knowing who you are and knowing a little bit about you and your family, to obviously ascribe generosity to you. But it seemed to me as if someone could misread what you were saying as a kumbaya sting in the tail that says both sides here must learn to tolerate each
other.
But quite frankly, there's no moral equivalence here between vulnerable pupils who do not have a monopoly on power in terms of how power is dispersed in institutions, as you know from your own experience, Josh, and the school's response here. So simply saying, liberals, please don't be liberals in one corner. Please have respect for conservatives. Conservatives, please have respect for liberals. I mean, there's an unintended equality there that made me uncomfortable. Josh?
Yeah, and you know, I want to be very clear about this. I do not think there is an equivalence. I want to be very careful about equivocating. What I was trying to get at, and it is a hard point to make convincingly,
sure,
is a kind of meta-narrative on the discussion, because here's the problem. You're right to say there isn't an equivalence, and you're right to say that we should defend vulnerable, you know, well-intentioned students making a protest which isn't very harmful and could be very impactful. So that's, you know, 100% right. At the same time, we need to understand that when the reaction to that on the right or in the Zionist community is outrage, and when the reaction to the outrage on the left is more outrage, the whole conversation goes backwards, right? So it's kind of weird contradiction.
Yeah.
Where if we defend and if we kind of just run at this in our own framework of values,
yes,
we end up going backwards, right? And that's the point I was making. And I know it can sound like kumbaya, but I think...
I get you. No, I totally get you, Josh. I've gone through that myself in relation to things like gay rights activism. Do you rest secure in your normative conviction, or do you wrestle with the horrid pragmatic question that if part of what you desire is to change the world, you may have to choose different things from your toolkit? And that's what I want Daniel to respond to. I share your politics, Daniel, but I wonder whether you would agree with Josh that even if there's a kind of liberal thought, that's how I'm brandishing here, that we might subjectively be convinced by,
yeah,
we need greater sophistication in how we go about trying to persuade or change the behavior of individuals and institutions who disagree with us, particularly the ones who disagree deeply. Let's take a break, then I'll give Daniel a chance, and then I want to bring Ilan back in here, and the whole world is now calling. I might have to extend this conversation.
Eusebius MacKaiser.
Eusebius MacKaiser.
On 702 at Cape Talk.
So, you and I are trained in normativity, Dan.
Mm-hmm.
In the real world, activists have to deal with stupidity, frustration, very good counter-arguments. And when you want to change the world, that's very different to writing a philosophical essay about the right to protest.
Sure.
Discuss 50 marks.
So what Josh said is true, which is that what happens is that you have two people in their own echo chambers, well, two factions of people in their own echo chamber shouting at each other when it comes to Zionism. You're either very, very much against it or very much for it. It's very hard to find some kind of sense of having a normal dialogue about it. And he's right. You're not going to change anyone's minds. Those people who bent the knee are not going to change anyone's minds. But I would argue that that does not mean that these protests become invalid, because what I went through in my time at a Jewish day school, is that I feel that what you need is you need to build up critical mass of dissenting thought to the point that how many people would agree with the views of the two who bent the knee, but who would be too afraid to express them? I don't know. That's why everyone said they were so brave, because you do a protest like that and you get a ton of hatred. So I would argue that these sort of protests need to be normalized to the point that in the Jewish community, it's accepted, because this is what the problem that I had with Bloomberg's response on Facebook, which is that he seemed to be saying, like you said, he seemed to be saying there are problems on both sides and you both need to come to the table. And that the reality is that the one side is an extremely weak minority of people who would protest this versus an extremely well-funded, well-heeled and powerful majority.
But here's the conundrum, right? Here's the practical conundrum. They think the same about you.
Do they think?
They think the same about you. They're chewing my producer's ears off there in the producer's booth, because as far as they are concerned, you are guilty of the same recalcitrance. You may not or may not be as well funded as they are. Josh's point, when he says meta, for me, his meta point is not just a theoretical point. It is a call to reflect on what is most conducive to constructive dialogue that actually ends in certain kinds of outcomes that make us less divisive as a community, even if we still have genuine political disagreement. On your methodology, is that prospect even one that arises?
I feel like I've tried to have this dialogue in a way that, like, let's change people's minds on it. And I have sadly come to the conclusion that you can't change people's minds on it. And that what you then have is a responsibility to speak your truth and to speak out against injustices where you see them. And it stops becoming a case of whether Joe Soap over there is going to be swayed and going to come around. Because to be honest, if I could sway Joe Soap, I would.
It would have happened by now.
But I don't feel I can. And so I feel that I need a mouthpiece. I need to speak to my truth, whether or not it's going to change people's minds.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
I hear you. I totally hear you. And Josh, if you're still going to be with us for another 10 minutes after the show, after this hour, I want you to respond to that. Daniel Kaliski made a similar point to you about the limitation of holding out hope for actual productive dialogue, even if your intentions are pure from a methods point of view. Gilad, good morning. Thank you so much for holding on.
Good morning, Eusebius. When people say that they're
not racist. You know that the next thing it's going to follow is they're going to say, when people say, I'm in favor of free speech, then they're going to immediately tell you how this free speech doesn't qualify. So I was against what the kids did, but I'm far more against by the incredible punitive response of the school and others who vilify them. What the kids did was a small issue. Let them have their say, even if it's a silent say. The total onslaught of people in the Jewish community to vilify them is awful. Yesterday, the chairman of the Zionist Federation kept on, Lohan Pollivan, in a blog, compared them to people who give aid to terrorists and Nazis. This is dangerous talk. It's like Judas Malema talk.
Yeah. Yeah,
and Jews should be careful of vilifying 15-year-old kids. A legal expert told me yesterday we could go to the Equality Court, and this is like Penny Sparrow stuff. So I advise Jewish people, stop the school, and certain people in the Jewish community have done, and to make this into a big matzah pudding, there needn't have been. If you're in favor of freedom of speech, listen and say, oh, well, I think that's bullshit, but don't do anything worse than that.
Thank you, Aguila. Thanks so much for calling in. Much appreciated.
I fully agree.
Of course, we wanted to have a one-hour conversation, but the issues are too complex, and I haven't even given you much of a chance to be engaged in it. I'm enormously grateful for my guests who are still with me, Deep Fried Man, comedian, and also Daniel Friedman, when he's digital editor of The Citizen. And then we also have a couple of the sharpest young minds in the country, in Josh Broomberg, who's all the way in Germany, and also Ilan Price, who is in Oxford. Thanks so much for staying, and I'm going to give each of you, Ilan and Josh, space for one last full comment. I'd love to have you longer, but I know you have busy days and schedules and planes and other things to catch as well. Ilan, I want to start with you, particularly based on your own experience. Can you reflect for me on, can you do two things for me? Reflect on the importance of what these learners might be going through now, what they may or may not be subjected to, so that their well-being now can be centered. And then any final thoughts that you have on any of the issues that we've raised?
Sure. I know time is tight, so let me try to combine those two. So I think that it's right, the conversation has moved to the question of whether there's a trade-off or whether there's a difference, distinction between rights and the protected space for these students and strategy of what's an effective protest.
Yes.
And I'll certainly offer that, agree that there's a lot that we should learn about how to effectively engage and change people's minds, and being angry, debating on Facebook is often not the best way. But I think we must recognize first and foremost that at least in this case, and often is the case, the rights are not a given. It is not the case that these rights are necessarily protected. It is still the case, for example, with these Herzliya students, that the sanctions as of yesterday morning are still in place, despite the second semi-retraction of the school. They still have to write essays, write apologies, not allowed to represent the school, are not allowed to talk to the media. So the question when you talk about what's effective, firstly as a strategy of protest, but also as a kind of backlash or a public response when this kind of thing happens, we should ask, is it only about changing minds? Is that the necessary thing we need to be focused on? First and foremost, I think we need to stop these actions. We need to stop the sanction of these students. And the second thing is that we should ask, has the protest actually been very effective? Is the fact of the news articles and the kind of public conversation that it's causing, is that part of its goal?
Hmm.
And the second is that, and thirdly, is this, it's true that we should have spaces for learners to learn about positive political engagement, positive public engagement, positive debate, positive conversation. But if schools are going to be a space which allows that, they cannot be spaces that shut down political expression. They have to be spaces that protect that political expression. And I think that's really the take-home message of this of this incident, which, as you say, is representative of a more broad principle that young people are able to and should be encouraged to be politically thoughtful and politically engaged.
Mm.
And quite the opposite of condemning them and shaming them publicly. They should be protected by the school, as is their responsibility, in particular when that school has knowingly and publicly given a particular slant or a particular angle to their education. They should be encouraged to act as critical thinkers, in particular in those circumstances.
Absolutely. Ilan, thanks for coming on. Very proud of everything you've achieved thus far in your career, and all the best with your studies. Thanks for being part of this conversation today.
Thanks for having me.
Cheers. That was Ilan Price, of course, former national head of Habonim Youth Organization. Josh Bruenberg. Josh, your final thoughts, and I wonder whether I can, in addition to whatever thoughts you want to raise, finally, also ask you to just reflect on something that, and again, part of my admiration for you is that you got here sooner than me as a trained competitive debater. The limitations of competitive debating, for example, formal logic and the way we sometimes wield dexterity in logical moves to try and emasculate our opponents in dialogue versus thinking harder about what we want to achieve with conversations that we open up. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, let me give it an attempt. And I'll try to connect it to what Ilan was saying right before me. You know, I think everything he said is 100% correct, right? This is an instance of completely legitimate speech by some students in an environment which should be safe and where discussion should be encouraged. And I think what you know, here's the irony. In, you know, as far as that is completely correct, it is correct. But in as far as the only way, you know, if everyone on this side of the aisle thinks it's correct and everyone on the other side of the aisle thinks they're correct, the only way that progress happens is through power, right? So the earlier comment by one of your guests really made me think about this, where he was like, we you know, it doesn't matter that we can't change minds. We've just got to build up support for this movement. We've got to get more and more support behind this, and hopefully things will change. And that is the way society has evolved. If you look at the responses on my Facebook post, you'll see people arguing that the only way society has changed is through violence and the expression of power in one way or another. And the point I'd like to make, even if it's very idealistic, is that, you know, regardless of the right and wrong in this situation, we need to evolve the way we have conversations.
Yeah.
Past the point where we're just like, here's what's abstractly right or wrong based on our values.
Yeah.
And get to a point where we say, like, look, we understand we're all human. We all have these kind of moral feelings, which we think are God-given truth. And, you know, actually have conversations which build collaborative opinions, I guess you could say, like, you know, actually have better conversation. And that's a very idealistic point I'm making. It's I'm not sure it's practically achievable given our biology, but it seems to me like there needs to be people saying this. There also needs to be people defending these boys, as I'm very glad there were people defending me. But someone needs to be saying that conversation needs to be better. And that's all I'd like to say.
Okay. Josh, all the best. Thanks so much for coming on. I know you're extremely busy. It was wonderful having your input in this discussion.
Thank you very much.
Bye. Josh Bruenberg, 14 minutes after 11.
Eusebius McKaiser. Eusebius McKaiser. On 702 and Cape Talk.
Just going to take a couple of your calls, and then I'm going to finish the conversation with Daniel, who's in studio with me. Rob, thank you for holding on. What did you want to say? Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I've got a few points. The first of these points is that I'm a slightly more optimistic about the impact of the protest, not maybe on its own, but as a part of a number of demonstrations, actions, expressions of opinion. Because I definitely agree that debates and arguments and protests aren't going to convince people who are sitting there, or hardline Zionists, to a very different about this point of view and have deep convictions. But I think often there's also a silent there's silent people that sometimes are a bit more ambivalent about their issues and aren't maybe comfortable before expressing doubts that become after this becoming bold, but also that maybe people that I think often in communities there are often people that have more ambivalent views and who are open to over process thinking through issues and at some point even a journey that will result in a change of opinion. I mean, I think these things can happen over time.
Okay.
So, and I also think that I'm also a bit more optimistic because when one looks at there certainly are shifts, particularly in America, particularly with the right wing Israeli government and the fact that how it's aligned itself with the most oppressive governments. There's been increasingly surveys showing that young Jewish Americans feel less identified with Israel and Zionism. So, and I think there's also a broader historical context in which Zionism, to different degrees at different points of history, has always been highly contested amongst Jewish people.
True.
Firstly, by Marxists such as myself, who were completely opposed to Jewish nationalism, but also Bundists who did not believe in a Jewish state in Palestine, the colonization of Palestine, but believed in a kind of in a socialist Jewish state or political entity where Jews lived in Eastern Europe.
There's another position one can occupy here that seems to me to be obviously being left out as well, Rob. Presumably, at least logically, one can be a Zionist and still think that it's awesome that these youngsters have a right to protest. So there's also a massive assumption being made here that someone cannot be a Zionist and critique politically the behavior of the Israeli state as they see it currently. Why is every critique of the Israeli state inherently a declaration of anti-Zionism?
I would agree with you. Now, I would not dispute that there are plenty of people who are Zionists who are who will critique at least aspects of the worst excesses, the checkpoints, the locking up of young children, some of the most oppressive activities of the Israeli state. However, there's no doubt that there's also a resurgence of Jewish anti-Zionism, which importantly views the entire oppression that occurred during occupation as symptomatic of a system and ideology that is based on a country not representing all those who live in it, like South Africa and our constitution, but a certain ethnicity.
Okay, fair enough. Sesapi, keep it very short for me. Hello, Sesapi.
Hello. Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thank you.
I'm good. I just wanted to say that I do think that school should be a legitimate place for political expression, but it lies with the background of the school, because we all know that most schools are predominantly white, and they have this background instilled with them to continue with their culture. And most schools instruct teachers not to talk any politics upon the students. And this reduces the confidence of the students, because students want to engage, but many are afraid that they might get into trouble because of these so-called rules. And regards to predominantly white schools, it's just brainwashing the rest of the small, diverse groups in that school that their culture is dismissed.
How old are you, Sesapi?
I'm 15.
And at your school, are people barred explicitly or otherwise from talking politics?
Teachers, when we follow the news, the students in my school that are politically active, when we follow the news and we ask our teachers, they give in small insights, but because they're strictly not allowed to talk on politics.
Fascinating. Thanks for sharing that. Our final caller for the day, Ben Detta.
Hi, Eusebio. Fabulous show.
Thank you.
I want to go back to your there were three questions you raised right at the beginning. Should schools be apolitical? And I'd like to answer that in conjunction with my answer to your second observation and raising the teenager with their inquiring mind, being a mother of three teenagers myself. I think schools should be apolitical. However, I agree with the previous caller that because teenagers are so inquiring and they're exposed to so much that it would be stifling for them not to learn by answering questions from whatever spectrum it comes, from left, that's right, from right, from center. I think it's very important that if it is political, it results in extremist viewpoints, and we've seen that in the show. And the clip that you played of the youngster was a clip of a really amazing mind, because he said exactly what I think you were referring to about globally what's happening in the world, the left versus the right. And this youngster said, yes, I respect that there's a right. Yes, maybe I'm performing like I'm a left, but let's speak and let's see where we can come in the middle. And I think that is commendable of this youngster. I really believe that's commendable. I'm not agreeing with the way that he did it, but I'm agreeing with his thought process.
Thank you so much. Dan, let's just spend 3 minutes wrapping this. Firstly, thank you for having been here longer than we had promised, including, which not all guests necessarily enjoy listening so generously to other people while I haven't pulled you in for the past 25 minutes into the conversation. We could take it in so many directions. I'll tell you one thought that comes up for me and then tell me what are the final issues you want to put up for the promise of a second installment of conversation. For me, one of the things come up amongst many things is this lie that schools could even be apolitical. When that 15-year-old who just calls in talks to us about silencing of political thought, I immediately thought to myself, who benefits from silence? And when there is a silencing of political thought and political expression, does that mean that you now have an institution that is apolitical or is value neutral? And of course, the answer is no, that is absolute BS.
No, you have fascism.
Absolutely. Yeah. So someone benefits. So schools are inherently drenched in their praxis, in the motto, in what you wear. They are drenched and steeped in history and culture and political identity.
Yes, and that's a very good point. And I think my biggest answer in terms of could you divorce politics from the situation at Herzliya, I would argue that if you're going to argue that political protest should not take place at school, then you need to argue that within a context of an apolitical school environment. And I would argue that reading Herzliya's website, what they're all about, they say they are a Jewish community school at providing a Jewish and secular education. Nowhere in its mandate does it say it's a Zionist school. I would then argue that the singing of HaTikvah at a school which is supposed to be a Jewish school and not necessarily a Zionist school is a political act. And to respond to that political act through a political protest is, you know, it's ridiculous to then try and divorce politics from the situation as if the singing of HaTikvah and if the instilling Zionist values in a school is not political in and of itself. That's the first thing. Second of all, I love the caller who said that he disagreed with the protest, but yet he thought that the response to the protest was even worse and that the response was dangerous. I love that. It did give me hope. When I said that I don't think you can change anyone's minds, I do think that the other caller who said that there are those who are sitting on the fence or who might be a bit scared to express their views, who might come out of their shell because of protests like this. And I agree with that too. So I don't entirely think that you can't change anyone's minds. I was more talking about the extremes on both the right and both the left. And on this issue, I would probably be seen as a member of that extreme. So I do think that it is valid in terms of changing people's, I do think it is important, maybe not this one, but I think acts like these over the years create a space where protests like this are more acceptable. And I think that's important.
Absolutely.
Also do respect what Josh was saying about the fact that we need to find better ways to discuss this. And I will say to Josh that over the years, I've always wanted to find a way of discussing this within the Jewish community in a way that it doesn't become polarized. And I have not yet discovered that.
Yeah.
But if it is possible, I mean, I would love to discover it someday. And I think it is great to aspire to
without
that.
Without collapsing into relativism.
Yeah. No, exactly. Without collapsing into relativism and also without having to water down your side of the ideology.
Yeah.
So, and the last thing I want to say is that, you know, having been to a Jewish day school, I don't think these things are unique to the Jewish community. I don't think any community in South Africa, we are a very polarized society, and all our little pockets of communities are in our own way conservative. And the Jewish community is no different to that.
Absolutely.
But I think What is encouraging to me is that in many ways, the Jewish South African community does encourage debate. What is discouraging to me is that there seems to be one issue where that's not the case. And that's this issue. Yeah. So, I would agree with that caller who said that even if you disagree with what those kids did, I hope you can find in your heart to understand that to clamp down on it and to react in a very sort of strong way is going to make the issue worse. And
100%.
That even if you disagree with the issue, you need to fight for people to be able to have their right to bend their knee.
Sorry, voice to men just entered my ear there. Digital editor of The Citizen, Daniel Friedman, thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.